Hey everybody, and welcome to the EV Cafe Takeaway, a podcast. It's focused on that zero emission future that you all hope for. Yes, it is. And every week, always, I get joined by one of the lovely team from the EV Cafe. I've got John with me this week. Hello, John.
Hello, gorgeous. I don't think I've ever been so nicely described as one of the gorgeous members. Now, you know, with such gorgeousness abounding, I'm the bottom of the barrel, my friend.
Well, you know, I'd love to disagree with you. But anyway, more importantly, we have innovators, pioneers, and collaborators on this here show. And this day, we have truly got an innovator, a pioneer, a collaborator, and an entrepreneur. Indeed, we have the wonderful Neil Riddell. And I got it right for the first time ever.
Thank you, Paul. Hey, John, how are you both doing?
I'm good, but I want to know, what's this name thing all about? So, Neil, N-I-A-L-L, Celtic background?
Scottish. And that keeps Scottish, that really good. Keeps people guessing, because my grandfather was a Neil with a more conventional spelling. He learned Scottish Gaelic, decided it'd be a cool idea to change his name, so he went to the deed poll, changed his name. And my parents thought that was a cool idea, so they gave me his name. So I have my Gaelic-speaking grandfather to blame for being Niall in England.
All the good things come from Scotland. Anyway, let's move on.
Indeed. Well, I'm going to lay claim. I did some discovery. I'm adopted and I was born in Bristol, but my original mother has one... She was 1/8 Scottish, so that makes me 1/16, I think, Scottish. Mm. McWhirter. There you go.
Well,
there you go.
As close to a Guinness World Record as you're going to get.
I think that's probably true. And for those of you not Gen X, apparently we're Gen X. We were told we were Gen X today, us older folks. But for all of you that don't know, there was a thing called Record Breakers with a wonderful man called Roy Castle and Norris McWhirter and his brother.
No idea.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to have to, I'll look it up.
But more importantly, let's get to the real point of this whole thing, which is Neil and the wonderful thing that he's created in Power. But Neil, listen, you're a bright man. Ever since we've been speaking, I remember our first conversation was me in the warehouse of Vital EV Solutions, walking around listening to you telling me how that we should be able to find charge points better. With better mapping and all of that kind of stuff. Listen, you're a bright guy. Have you always been such?
No. I am. I guess if you roll right back, I read my old school reports recently, and I wasn't particularly bright at school. And I guess the thing that I learned was how to learn, and therefore I'm quite good at learning, but I'm not necessarily the brightest person on the topic. If you give everyone enough time, I think you suddenly find that, you know, everyone will be an expert. But unfortunately, the quicker you can learn, the more you become a beginner of an expert. So I do not classify myself as an expert. There are people who know a lot more than a lot of things about me. But it's all about trying to keep up with everyone, learn as quickly as possible, and avoid being called Gen X too often.
Very good.
So... electric vehicle charging. You don't just wake up in the morning and think, right, I'm going to invent something. What shall I do? And say, oh yeah, I'm going to go and find more charge points and maps and stuff. Talk to me about the journey that led to Power. Why do electric vehicles and where chargers are matter to you so much?
I'm going to go right back, if I may. I did an engineering degree. Came out of that, wanted to get into the world of water and clean water. Couldn't get a job in clean water and ended up getting a job in decommissioning nuclear power stations. So I ended up on the north coast. I know. I ended up on the north coast of Scotland as a chemical engineer, decommissioning a old nuclear power station called Dounreay. And I did that for a year and variously went on a journey with the nuclear industry, which led to me sitting in a role at British Energy as an environmental and energy policy analyst. So almost on the halls of Whitehall all of a sudden. So from nuclear waste into Whitehall area. And that led to a stint in the Committee on Climate Change. So I spent 9 months before it was formally a committee on climate change writing carbon budgets. Go on, John, I'm sure you're going to ask something there.
No, I wasn't. No, I'm fascinated. I had no idea. I've known you for years and I didn't know any of this stuff. So, right, go. Sorry, keep going.
Yeah, so it was that was the moment when I was like, actually, you know what? It was really interesting exploring water and radiation and, you know, all that sort of decommissioning stuff. But actually, climate change is massive and huge and it's got massive opportunities and potential and, you know, all sorts of stuff that we as a generation need to handle. So that kind of kickstarted the, you know, the sustainable renewable energy interest. At the time, we did a load of calculations. I remember seeing things like solar PV being like £700 or £800 a megawatt hour to generate. You know, it's like, oh, that's never going to happen. You know, and of course, we had, you know, CCS in there, which was going to come down to something like, you know, £55 a megawatt hour. It's like, well, the future is clearly CCS. And as you went on this journey exploring this, one of the things that jumped out at me was how, and I learned, was how innovators shape the changes that we really see. So, you know, fast forward a little bit, solar suddenly started to get rolled out. Everyone was like, well, hang on, my educational knowledge piece said it should be really expensive. And yet everyone's doing it. Why is that? And of course, there were things like the feed-in tariff and the CFD, and that all drove this transition, this change. But I was constantly getting exposed to other entrepreneurs, other innovators who were shaping the way our energy system is evolving. And I kind of made a little promise to myself back then that if I could see another changing trend, I'd try and get involved at a smaller, scrappier stage than a large corporate stage, because large corporates just missed the story. They, you know, you catch up 12 months, a year later, and you go, well, hang on, what happened? Where did that come from? It's like the opportunity's gone, you know? So I sort of developed this passion for edgier things. And I was in a huge corporate at the time. I worked for EDF Energy. It's one of the largest electricity generators in the world. And I was sat inside this huge corporate and things were happening and I was missing them. And it was kind of disappointing me. I'd done an MBA. So all of a sudden I was in this territory whereby, you know, I had a business education and I knew I wanted to do a business, but you know, you can't do that inside a large corporate. And it was like, I lived this world of, you called me an entrepreneur earlier, which is great because I lived for a long time as a chicken entrepreneur. You know, I knew that it was a great idea, but I was just too frightened of doing it. And one of my good friends said, Neil, your problem is you just need to throw some balls and just go and do it. And the kind of secondary lessons that fall out of that were, it's never a good time. If you're going to do something, you kind of just got to go and do it. And anyhow, I sat down with my now business partner, who I'd known for a while. We were on a board together. I sat down with him and we started discussing this idea of electric vehicle charging. And at the time, I was running the electric vehicle team at EDF. We were rolling out business solutions, domestic solutions. We were doing a bit of vehicle to grid. You know, we were exploring the whole gamut, including putting a lot of money into charge points. I sat down with him and I said, hey, Andre, I got this idea. You know, there's all these charge points. They're like internet connected devices, you know, so we can get data from them. We can tell people where they are and what they do. And we can join it all together and send them signals, collect all the information and collect the payments and manage, you know, that payments journey. And he said, oh, well, Neil, the problem you've got is it's not a technical problem. It's a commercial problem. I was like, well, I can get the contracts. I can find the people. I can build the relationships. And he's like, well, I'll build it. And it was that moment when we went like, actually, you know what? There's a challenge, you know, charging back in, I don't know when was this? This was like 2018, 2019. Still quite fragmented. It was quite challenging to get out on the road and charge. And therefore, we kind of started going, this will work. How do we put it together? And that was kind of the beginning of that journey.
Fantastic. I love the sort of process of becoming an entrepreneur. I mean, it covers a multitude of sins, right? You know, in terms of all of the different things that we can do. What do you think is in your makeup that gives you that? What was it about your upbringing? What was it about your life that gave you that ability to grow a set of balls and do something big?
So one of the things I learned during my MBA, which surprised me and gave me a little bit of confidence, was most entrepreneurs have been exposed to entrepreneurship as a child. So many entrepreneurs have had either a parent or a relative who's gone and set up and run a business. So you don't tend to find entrepreneurs who've had big corporate career parents all their lives. It tends to be people who've had that experience. My father was a doctor. He ran a small medical practice and, you know, had to sit and do his accounts and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, when you sort of see that behavior, you kind of get your head around the idea that know, although I was in a large corporate, you can do a lot of these things yourself. And it sort of gives you those early seeds of confidence. And like I mentioned to you, I was kind of speaking to a lot of people in this space and I wanted to be involved. Every time I went and took a job interview at a small company, they're like, oh, you're from a big corporate, you can't do this. And I was like, at the end of the day, I was like, okay, well, the only way I'm going to be able to do this is like just jump ship and go and do it. And it's quite an interesting question you asked because this book, which I'm holding, is called Corporate Escapology. It's written by a guy called Adam Forbes. It's all about that question. How do you escape a large corporate and what are the lessons? And he's got, I don't know, he's interviewed like 50 or 100 people for this. And he interviewed me for this. And one of the questions that we explored together was, how do you prepare yourself when you're a large corporate for that exit? And a lot of what I was doing at the time was consciously going, oh, I might need to learn about how to write a contract, so I'll spend more time listening to the lawyers. Oh, I might need to learn how to run some accounts, I better make sure I understand how accounts are set. And I spent quite a lot of time doing all of these kind of activities inside the large corporate, preparing myself for leaving. But underlying it, you leave, and then the most mundane things are really hard to do. And it was it took me 6 months to work out how to pay HMRC. And I for some reason, I just couldn't get the mechanism set up to pay HMRC. So one of the first bills I paid was to HMRC for late payment of tax, because I just hadn't worked out how to pay them. But, you know, inside a large corporate, you never learn that. So, you know, quite quickly you go, you know, there were a bunch of hard lessons. So it's all about this idea of, you know, constantly having to learn and constantly changing what you do.
I love that because I can draw some comparisons to myself. I mean, I don't consider myself an entrepreneur because I've just kind of stepped out of the corporate world and I've found a way to make that pay. I would love to, like, scale this experience into being able to employ people and do all of that kind of thing, because I would love to be able to go a bit further. You can go quickly, you can be nimble as an individual, but you can't actually build something that will last beyond this husk of a body. Do you know what I mean? When this goes, it's gone, it's over. And I'd love, we can explore this all more another day. I mean, so how do we get to power? What, you know, because it's a really cool name, very, very clever. Obviously, you know, if it had been an L, it'd have been Paul. But of course, that wouldn't have had the same ring.
We do get people who write to us and say, Dear Paul. And the other one we get is Dear Paula, because you've got clearly the autocorrect has gone and they've dropped an L, they've made a typo, so they change it across. We do get emails.
So how did Power come about, the name, let's say?
The background here is my wife's a Kiwi. So in New Zealand, they have this abalone shell, which is effectively the power shell. And that power shell is, you know, it's a Maori recognized shell. Everyone in New Zealand knows about it. So, you know, my wife was like, why don't you call it Power? Because, by the way, power.com was taken. So paua.com happened to be available. We bought the domain and we started the business off the back of that. And then I kind of felt like we needed a brand color. And my daughter was about 3 years old at the time. And I said to her, hey, what's your favorite color? She said pink. I was like, okay, cool. Not many pink brands out there. Let's go pink. And I see John has done me the courtesy of putting his pink lighting on in the background. Thanks very much. But the journey really was, you know, we're putting pins on a map. And if you spend time looking at Google Maps, which we were at the time, Google doesn't use pink. So as soon as you put a pink pin on a map, it stands out. So it was quite an easy decision to go, hang on, you know, pink's, you know, like a bright, strong pink just helps us with the, you know, the visual aid for the drivers when they're looking at a Google map and see a load of pink pins on it.
A key strength for you, Neil, I think, is that you have an incredible way with people and making people feel special. And I guess as an entrepreneur, some aren't good at articulating what they do, how they do it, and good at engaging people, but you are. Have you always been somebody who finds making friends easy and getting those relationships to work?
This is a really interesting question, which has got a couple of layers to it. When I was younger, my grandfather famously said to my mother, she said, when are we ever going to hear from Neil? And I was quite quiet as a child. And clearly something changed and I'm trying to make up for it now. But yeah, you know, some might say I let the sound of my own voice. But I've kind of found this journey whereby you've got to articulate what you're doing. And I actually, if I'm brutally honest, I'm probably not very good at articulating what I'm doing. And therefore I keep practicing. And eventually we're going to find the perfect form of words that explains what it is we're up to. As a business, we're a marketplace. So we're sat between two groups of parties, providers of charge points, be they public, home, workplace, and the drivers and the fleets and the businesses that run these vehicles. We kind of got to play this constant middleman role where I've got to keep both sides of my equation happy and with some value. Because without that, the marketplace doesn't need to exist. So consequently, I have to spend a lot of time speaking to charge point operators going, hey guys, this is a great idea. We should be doing this. Or by the way, we've got all this insight. How can we help you? And on the other side, it's like, hey guys, we can introduce you to all of these charge point operators and simplify that whole journey through the middle. So we kind of had to play this middleman role, which suits me personally quite well. However, it does let me down. If you go and speak to the big VCs, interestingly, the kind of characteristics and persona they want is not someone who's nice to them. They really like it when they get an aggressive, nasty, I'm taking over the world person. And I found that quite challenging. So when I go and speak to VCs, they often come across and they go, oh, well, Neil's really nice. I really had a lovely chat with him, but he's not aggressive enough. He's not taking over the world. And I'm like, oh, thanks, guys. But I hit my targets. So, you know, that's a trade-off for the VCs out there.
Can I just step in here just for a moment, John, because you know what I'm going to do. I need your knuckles. There we go. Naughty. Venture capitalists. VCs. There's a lot of people out there that don't know what this, you know, PE and VC, you know, they think something else for PE. And VC is like...
sweaty vest.
Should we run through it quickly? So, my very first money that came into the business came from what is called a friends, families, and fools round. You sometimes see it written as F&F. The friends, families, and fools are the people who put the very first capital into the nut pots who are going to go and start these businesses. And let's be quite frank, it's usually based on a PowerPoint presentation, a crazy entrepreneur, and I'm going to make it happen. So someone silly enough to put some money in, and a good friend of mine was silly enough to put some money in. So thank you, Johnny. He put the first cash into the business. You've then got like a choice. Do you build a sustainable business, which has got profit from day one, and then you never need to go and raise again because actually it's not about that growth story. It's about building a sustainable model. Or you go and raise money from a group of investors who can be called and variously labeled angels, HNWIs, high net worth individuals, VCs, venture capitalists, or private equity. The reality is private equity doesn't really play at the small end of this journey. And what's been really interesting is a lot of the early charge point operators took money in the VC and angel space. But if you look at charge point operators now, it's a much less risky business model. Entrepreneurs basically have a risky business model at the beginning. It's an idea. So that's where the angels or the venture capitalists step in. It's high risk, but they expect huge returns, like not 10%. They're looking at 10x. So these guys want high risk, high growth, high opportunity business models. When you get to private equity, which is basically where we're getting to with a lot of our charge point operators, it's much more stable, it's much more known, and therefore you get things like debt coming in, because debt's happy to be paid 8 or 9% a year rather than being paid 10 times their original investment. So this is the kind of journey with money that we're trying to get into as we go along that journey, and I promise I won't use any more acronyms.
well done. But it's crazy, isn't it? The journey around charging and all of this sort of stuff and everybody trying to find where they're at. And let's be honest, you know, the risk is not going to go away because the cost of energy is tricky at the moment. And then the public cost of energy is really tricky. What are your thoughts around that journey and how do you feel that you'll play a part in it?
This is a really juicy area. I've got a bunch of views and I've started to call them a list of unpopular opinions. It's a topic which I can go into in a lot of detail. I think the first thing I almost always start on is if you're going to compare apples and apples, you need to make sure we're talking about the same thing. So as soon as you start talking about public charging, you've got to recognize that is the total cost of charging. So you're paying for the electricity, you're paying for the depreciation on the asset that's been built, the grid connection, the service, the maintenance, the insurance, all of that stuff. So you see, I don't know, let's say 85p on a public charge point. You go, that's really expensive. But you break it down and you go, well, you've got high convenience in a very nice location on a motorway services area, and you're on the road and you can get a coffee and you're going to get a 300 kilowatt charge or something crazy. Then you go down to the other side and you go, actually, my home charging only cost me 7 pence overnight. No, your marginal cost of electricity is 7 pence overnight. You paid for the charger. You have the privilege of having a driveway, because, by the way, that is a privilege, and there's a whole group of people who don't have driveways. You've got a grid connection to the house already, and you pay a standing charge for access to that grid connection. You probably forgot to insure it, so it's probably not on your insurance, but, you know, everyone remember to put your home charger on your insurance. And then you probably never even considered the O&M costs. Now, I'm on my second home charger. My first one broke, and I had to just basically replace it. Don't look at me like that, Paul, because you'll force me to expose who the brand is. Anyhow, the first one broke.
I was thinking of your promise. You promised not to.
He's reaching for the ruler.
What was my acronym?
O&M.
Oh, damn it. Okay, wrap the knuckles again. Operations and maintenance, which is effectively all of the stuff that's required to, all the stuff that's required to ensure that we keep these things running effectively and reliably. So that O&M, operations and maintenance, is something that you at home probably don't think about. You might wipe your charger down once every couple of months. And when you stack all those costs back together, public charging suddenly doesn't look as bad as we thought it did. And I have the really dirty and unpopular opinion is, I believe in the long run, public charging will be cheaper than home and workplace charging. Now, the reason I say that is ultimately it's a physical asset which makes its return or spreads its cost over utilization. If you use your home charger once or twice a week and the on-street charger is getting 2 sessions a day, it's going to do 14 sessions versus your 2. So the depreciation of the cost is spread out much more. Same story on putting a 50 kilowatt charger in your workplace. If that charger is just being used to charge a vehicle once a night, it gets 7 sessions or 5 sessions a week. That public charger will be doing 5 or 7 sessions a day. So in theory, spreading the cost out over many, many more uses, you should see lower costs in public than you will in the workplace. Where does that fall down? It falls down when you start sharing that infrastructure. So we know that, you know, companies like CoCharger and everybody share at home, and we're now starting to open up this idea of sharing in the workplace, and that enables you to get increased revenue, increased utilization. So I think there's really interesting tension in here once you start considering apples and apples for your pricing, that actually you can see public or, you know, shared infrastructure becoming a really cost-effective way of, you know, providing that component service to your fleet operations. Plus, Paul, and the last one, nobody cares about price in my world. You've got to remember that this is an operational impact on your fleet. If you spend a lot of time driving out of your way to get 5 pence cheaper, you probably lost all the value of that 5 pence within a minute of driving off the road. So quite quickly, it's more about convenience and being able to provide the service and reduce the operational impact.
You're absolutely right, Neil. That sort of cost of energy is incidental in versus convenience, but when you do the total cost of ownership, typically it's very hard to factor in the intangible of time, but very easy to factor in the very tangible of cost. And you know, the great example, AW Energy, right? With their Leighton Buzzard site, 39 pence a kilowatt. We know that we can't replicate this across the country, but we'll probably get to bits of it. But at 39 pence a kilowatt hour, they're making money. Wow. And they're delivering a very efficient service, high powered charging. And, you know, businesses can do a bit of work whilst they're there and all that good stuff, and then they get on their way. But at the end of the day, the unquantifiable is how many times you have to come out of your way, how much time is that? Because time, if you were to take an average, it's around about £100 an hour for a van to be sitting down. So about £750 a day. It's about £750 a day for the operational use and value of a vehicle. So if you've lost an hour of productivity time, you've lost around about £100. So there you go.
That's a good stat to run with. And I mean, I'm assuming you haven't included the cost of the employees' time in there.
No, so around £750 a day is about
full
the cost, yeah.
Okay, I'm stealing that. Thank you very much. I guess you've called out the guys at AW Energy who are doing a great job. We've got a couple of our other partners who are also going down this road of like really making it super affordable. The team at Mylance announced their 39.9 yes. pence ex-VAT, so 45 pence inc VAT. The team at First Bus have been pushing really hard to try and drive some, you know, shared depot pricing that makes it really attractive. And I think what we're starting to see is a tension, a really interesting and healthy tension in how people are pricing their public charging networks, because you've still got your 85p's out there. But if you've got a 45p that you can access, you know, there's a question around, can you build that into your journey and really enable that to be part of your lower total cost of ownership?
One of the key challenges, Neil, with setting up and running a business is scaling. And we talked about money. One of the other things which is always a challenge is people and getting the right people to work with. And I'm fascinated by your recruitment process because, let's be honest, you work with some absolute lunatics who love, not just like, they love their jobs. I saw a post this week from Laura Hustwick-Wilkes who said, it's not a job, it is everything. She loves power. She loves what she does. How do you find people like Laura, like Pam?
So to become a Power Ranger, John, you've got to pass the Power Rangers exam. we've been very fortunate to find some A, very passionate, and B, very skilled and talented people. I guess one of the things that I personally reflect on is I've done the long, complex interview process, you know, which has got stages and tiers and different people and stuff. And it's like, well, how does that benefit the individual? What we've always struggled with is, you know, we are a remote team. You know, we're physically remote. Laura's up in the north, and Pam, who does our sales, is in Leeds. You know, I've got a couple of developers out in Portugal. You know, we've got a proper spread of people. So you have to kind of gauge on a call like this, you know, 35, 40 minutes, you're going to recruit someone who's going to be with you for the next 3 to 4 years. And it's a brutally hard process. And I don't think we've nailed it, but we're slowly picking up tips and ideas as we go along around what it is that we can do to find the crazy lunatics who are prepared to go the extra mile for the customer and create the customer results. And then it's obviously about how do you skill, grow, develop, bring them together and try and get some form of crazy Power Ranger love inside the team so that everyone goes, yeah, pink is the best color on the planet. And it's, you know, it's been challenging, but we've got some really, really cool people. And it's, you know, thank you for saying such nice things, because it is a very cool group of people we've managed to bring together to try and deliver this task of, you know, keeping our fleet customers on the road in zero carbon fashion.
So you recruit for passion rather than for necessarily skills, and then you teach people how to do things the way that you do them.
A bit of both. I think, you know, passion will get you an enormous distance where, you know, skills might not. You know, there was a McKinsey who I did a bit of work with a number of years ago used to describe this thing called the skill will matrix. And they would say, we want people who are high on the skill will matrix. So your dream candidate is someone who's like just super enthusiastic, really capable, grabs stuff and goes. You know, it's the fire and forget missile analogy. You know, here's a task, go and do it. And they just go off and do it. And, you know, those people are gold dust. Every time you find one of them, it's genius. But if you've got someone who's super passionate and you can see the raw refinement of the skill, there's things you can do to help shape that skill and get them up into that skill wheel territory. And there's a guy at Revolut who talked a little bit about hiring and the ideal team. And he basically said, listen, you know, those people you can go, you know, military language, capture the hill, you know, there it is, there's the target, you know, go set the target. They're amazing. But if you can find people who come to you and go, I want to capture that hill, because that's even better. So, you know, if you can get that combination of like desire, but also their own ability to grasp the problem, identify the solution and drive towards the solution. And that's, you know, kind of where we're trying to get to.
You got there.
Fantastic. Do you know what, Neil? this is lovely, right? I love understanding and hearing all about this business mindset and how you've grown this business. But do you know what I like? A little sneaky, interesting fact about the man himself. And, you know, when we do a little bit of pre-work, of course, and we talk to you and try and understand what's made this man. And I wonder, because lightning comes into this conversation and maybe lightning strikes. And it was plural as well, as lightning struck twice. And what's the connection with butterflies? I mean, anyway, but start with lightning because, you know, it's power related, of course. You know, did you get like a million volts traveling through you that now is going into the world of business?
Possibly. Yeah, I got struck by lightning once. And then a few months later, I got struck by lightning again. So what? The first time I got struck by lightning, the first time I got struck by lightning, I was sailing up in Edinburgh and I was, you know, storm came in. So we decided to pull the boat in. We were soaking wet, but, you know, wearing wellies and sort of outdoor gear. And we're pulling this boat in on its, you know, its little trolley. And I'm holding this trolley and basically the lightning struck the mast. But it wasn't forked lightning, it was sheet lightning. So it basically went through the harbour. And it basically just left me with a jolted arm. I felt a bit like I dislocated my shoulder or something, and my hair was all a bit weird and all that sort of stuff. And it was like, it wasn't until afterwards, like, that was actually a lightning bolt, which is kind of weird. But some months later, I think possibly there's like a charge or whatever. Anyhow, I was standing behind a window, so it was slightly different. I was inside this time, and the same thing happened. It was effectively like just came down onto the property, and it was like through the property. So yeah, struck by lightning twice. Not completely mad yet, but probably getting there. The butterfly story.
Neil,
yeah, go on.
Before you go on, it just struck me. I'm going to rename you now. You are now known as Rod.
Thank you.
Rod Riddell.
There you go. Got a new name. I didn't think I was getting a new name on this podcast, but there you go. Hello, my name's Rod. Yeah, I can make that work.
And you like butterflies?
The butterfly link is, as a child, my father had identified that where we went on holiday in Scotland, which was later my family house, had no peacock butterflies. So it's a little... Go and pick up a map of butterflies in the UK, you'll find that they've got little dots in each of these squares. And we were living in a square that had no dot in it. And we established that it was a up in Glen Lyon in Scotland, and it's basically a very long, narrow glen. So you've got mountains on either side. And the butterfly population had died out. And because it couldn't go far enough up during the summer period, and then it got killed off over the winter, they never established themselves. So anyhow, we basically used to travel up and down from Devon, where I lived, with a cage of butterfly caterpillars in the back of the car. So every time we go off on our summer holidays, we'd have this cage of butterfly caterpillars. And I'm proud to say there are now peacock butterflies in Glen Lyon that we introduced from the south of Devon. So it's like it's a weird backward story, but it ties together in the context that it's kept me very aware of the natural world. So I spend a lot of time. I've got three children. I spend a lot of time talking to them about tadpoles and all sorts of various things that are happening around us. Like I'm hoping to take them to see a starling murmuration later this year. We spend a lot of time looking at nature, and it all came from that experience of traveling up and down the M5 with a box full of caterpillars in the boot.
Gosh, not least, that is some journey, isn't it? Devon to Glen, wherever it was,
Glen Lyons, right in the middle of Scotland.
Lyons. Yeah, I mean, that's a heck of a journey. Yeah. My goodness, and beautiful. But I must admit, one of my most memorable moments is taking my daughter to get tadpoles in a wood in the middle of Bedfordshire. You know, it's just a great moment, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a real connection because you you see the passing of the seasons, you become more aware of what the impacts are. And one of the things I've noticed, weirdly, is, you know, I'm down in London, you see less and less tadpoles. It's almost, you can almost feel the impact that, you know, it's being having on frogs and other amphibians because they just don't have the same quality of water that we used to have.
Right, let's get to the future. Ooh. Let's look a little forward. What now? So we've talked about your core proposition. We've talked about sharing and we've talked about assets for business and all that stuff. What's next?
It's really interesting, John. One of the things we've observed over the last 4 or 5 years as we've been building the business is that the landscape is constantly evolving and constantly changing. And therefore, one of the things we've got to remain aware of is that different needs come up from different parties as we go down this route. So a couple of themes we're looking at very heavily at the moment. One of them is truck charging. Electric mm-hmm. trucks are coming. If you sit and look at it from, a pure business perspective, there's really not that many on the road yet. You know, several hundred, maybe hitting, just about to hit 1,000 vehicles on the road. And you suddenly go, okay, well, why build a solution for them? You know, there's just not a big enough marketplace. But the other side of it is if we build a solution, it helps more people gain confidence they can put electric trucks into their fleet. So we're spending a lot of time almost, I see it as like a vote of confidence on our side in the rest of the industry that we're trying to help build something that will give others confidence. When we've done the homework, we think there's about 20 to 30 companies building dedicated commercial vehicle and truck charging infrastructure. So everyone from the Mylances, who, very well publicized, owned by the big OEMs, through automotive, original equipment manufacturers, through to, through to people like Aegis Energy, who's a new business, who's going to build commercial vehicle charging just for commercial fleets, but including those trucks within it. And then you've got the BPs and the Shells and the grid serves who are already here, but now they're extending their proposition into those larger sites. So I think truck charging is really clever because it's going to be really about physics, higher power, more energy, bigger batteries, physically larger sizes. It's quite straightforward. I think we can learn a lot from the car journey, but with different applications, and we're learning ourselves that all of a sudden it might not be the driver we're talking to, it might be the transport planner who we're talking to who's going to book the site. So booking now becomes a really crucial piece, and I've long held the unpopular opinion that booking for cars and vans is a bit of a waste of time. We know that 20% of charge point operators on the HubJet platform have the ability to offer booking. 0.2% of all sessions are booked. So in my view, it's a complete fallacy. I think customers love the idea that they might be able to book, but none of them actually do it. So for me, cars and van booking is a really tricky question. And I can see Paul making faces at me, which is great. I'm annoying him. So cars and vans, I think booking doesn't make so much sense. When you get into the larger commercial vehicles, rigid vehicles, trucks, probably those who have specific duty cycles, you can see a much more important role for booking. So I think we're going to see booking getting driven by trucks and then enable the feature for some of the cars and vans. But I still don't fundamentally believe that cars will book that much. There will be niche use cases, overnights at hotels. I think that's always a good one. But realistically, I think, most people are now increasingly going confident they can find infrastructure. Part of the reason for that, unpopular opinion number three, I think we're on, is realistically, I think we've overbuilt infrastructure in the UK. We have more charging infrastructure than we need right now. This is supply and demand economics. We've built a lot of chargers. Those chargers are doing, on average, less than 3 sessions a day. When you do the financial analysis, it needs 5, 6, 7, 8 charging sessions a day to get break even. So unfortunately, we've sunk capital into infrastructure. And now we've got the charge point operators going, we need more utilization. We need more utilization. And they do. But the vehicles aren't there. So we kind of got this slight imbalance on supply and demand, which we will see until we get to 100% stable transition. So I think we've got a lot more infrastructure. So cars are confident they can find a charge when they go to most locations, unless it's Easter Day, Christmas Day, one of those really peak periods. But as a driver, I don't tend to think about booking. I tend to think I'll go to here because I can get a good coffee. And if not, I'll go around the corner because I know there's another charge around the corner. But trucks and commercial, vehicles are probably going to need that as part of their operational practice going forward. So it's great to see that concept of booking coming down from the trucking world. And then the other one I think I'm excited about is plug and charge, 15118. Then 15118, for those who aren't familiar with it, it's not 15 lemonades. It's an international standard that enables you to pull up, plug in, and the car and the charger do a little handshake, and it enables the charging to start automatically. So no more apps, no more cards, plug it in, off you go.
At last.
We're not there yet, but I think it's in the future.
And all of these are exciting, but of course I'm going to just quickly take issue that I think vans need booking. Because we are still at the very low end. We're still at the very low end, and to jump vans and get to trucks is I think as a mistake, because if we ignore vans, we can practice with vans, right? You know, because it scales up in terms of value and getting it right. So if you get a truck wrong, you cost that truck and that business and that industry a lot of money. You get it wrong with a van, you do cost a lot of money. But why wait till we have to really reach to get it right? Let's start practicing. Let's get on with it. And vans will benefit, and vans will, they might have other solutions. And I recognize that it is ultimately probably more important in trucks, but it's still very important in vans. Anyway,
I'm not giving you the chance to respond. I'm going to take the challenge. This second half of the year, we will focus on booking and we'll enable it for vans as well. That's what I'm going to try and do.
Okay. And I'll make sure I'm one of your bookings with my van out there. There you go.
Deal.
Now then, Neil,
I'm already baking the humble pie that he's going to have to eat when you show him the data.
But the data, you can't expect it all just to happen overnight. Education is one of the critical things here, and getting that messaging out. The fleets are really challenged with so many different things. It's when you get to 100% adoption that we are going to really need this stuff. So I agree, your utilization case is a really important one. AW Energy again bucked the trend by generating their own utilization numbers that went through the roof because their numbers came down in terms of cost, and then they met all their targets. You know, so utilization does not need to be a problem. The price is the problem, and that's where utilization will then come from, because you change people's mindset. Anyway, now then, we have a closing tradition, Neil. And yes, we have got to get you ready to move on to your next appointment. And we have a closing tradition. You may know this. I hope you do know this closing tradition. It's a very special one. And it's where we present you with the EV Cafe magic wand, all with lightning bolt included, which has never been more apt. So you're about to get struck by lightning once again in the form of the magic wand. So here it comes. It's coming through the camera to you, and there you go. You there, that's my man, good man. So you're now in possession with the magic wand, aka a pen, also known as, just saying, no acronyms. What is one wish, and you ain't get one wish that you would like to request from the powers that be for your world?
One of the things that makes me really nervous in an early stage market is overregulation. You know, there's an old Ronald Reagan quote about, you know, if it moves, moves, tax it. If it stops moving, subsidize it. And if it keeps moving, regulate it. And we're in that territory where we are moving. Our industry is moving. And unfortunately, we're starting to see some regulation coming in. I wish that all regulators, by law, cannot pass any form of electric vehicle charging regulation unless they're an EV driver. And the reason for that is they would then start to understand the implications of the decisions they're imposing on others. And therefore, my wish is that all policymakers in government who are going to make regulation on electric vehicles will also be electric vehicle drivers.
Brilliant. Amen.
Quite famously, Donald Trump has just signed away California's electric vehicle mandate, and he's a Tesla owner. What a bizarre man.
I thought he was selling his Tesla.
Well, that's going as well, yeah. Anyway, let's not get hung up on that. I have loved today, and I knew I would. And the reason is that, Neil, you are one of those people who has an incredible grasp of not only your own business, but the world. Thank you. You see things in a very clear, logical way. You don't get over emotional, unlike some. You just tell it as you see it. You're full of passion, but you measure it and you deliver it with such joy. And you've still got time for the people around you, the little things in the world, like bugs and birds and rivers and all that stuff. You're a good fella, Charlie Brown.
Thank you very much.
Do you know what I've loved today is you would be forgiven for thinking that power is a big business. That it's like, you know, big. And that you can, I mean, we can name a couple of other brands that, that have the type of technology and stuff like that that you do. But I believe that you are really, truly influencing the world that you inhabit for good. You're helping facilitate, you're helping drive the conversation, because it's clear to me that you have got your eyes on the horizon. You've got your gaze firmly fixed on what the future might hold and how you can make a difference to it. And I love that. And I've always loved it. And it's not often that I completely remember a very first conversation. And I completely remember a very first conversation with you, or very first proper conversation. We might have spoken before, but it was, it's quite impressive. And I love what you're doing. I love your team. And well, I'm not going to say I love you, but you know, I love you.
I love you too. All I'm looking for you to do is say, go, go Power Rangers.
And after three, John, one, two, three,
go, go Power Rangers. If that's synchronized, I'll be amazed.
Well, that'll be Joe's challenge to synchronize it. So the gauntlet is laid down, the wand has been used, the time has been spent, and we have had a wonderful day with Neil Riddell. I got it right twice.
In AKA Rod.
Excellent. Rod.
AKA Rod, yes. So, Neil, thank you for your time today. Thank you for doing what you're doing and being the person that you are. We are so blessed to have you in our world. And, yeah, we look forward to the next opportunity where we'll meet face-to-face and share a platform somewhere to talk about and argue about, you know, booking and vans and trucks and all of those kinds of things. But in the meantime, everybody, do check out Power. Their website will be in there. And if you need a charging card, I can recommend it. It's very good. I use it quite often. They have a very wide network of people that you can kind of just tap and go. That's really nice. And so check out that. Check out Neil. Connect with him on LinkedIn. But don't look for Neil. Look for Niall. You'll find him. Just check out all of our other podcasts, you know, Spotify, Apple, all of that good stuff. And if you care to, just leave us a little kind of review. Give us 5 stars and all that good stuff. But in the meantime, have a great day, everybody. Thanks, John. Thanks, Neil. Pleasure. Take care, everybody.
Take care. Cheers, guys. Yeah.